Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Cleet Belock, and we're going to be talking about the factors of human relationships. Dr. Belock formed a consulting agency called the Professional Development and Assessment Center, PDAC. The agency provides training to improve leadership skills in human relations, conflict management, and group management. Personnel from the agency serve as evaluation and research design consultants. School districts that want to develop data-driven school improvement plans and that are further designed to improve the quality of instruction have found the services of PDAC to be beneficial. You can find out more by visiting Dr. Cleet's website, www.westga.edu, /CBULACH. But there is a direct link to his website in the show page description, so that makes it easy for you to access. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Belock to the show. Good day, sir.
Hey, good afternoon. Pleasure being on your show, Robert.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I'm really looking forward to helping the listeners understand and improve their relationships better. So I guess, Dr. Cleet, I guess the first place we should start with is, in your opinion, through your studies, why do people behave the way they do?
And that's a question that people have been asking since the beginning of time. And, of course, you could ask it right now about President Trump. Why does he behave the way he does? And the strange thing is the philosophers in the 18th century talked about this. And if you go on the web and you want a little background on this, I'm having a senior moment right now. The first one said that people behave the way they do because they want to live. And if you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, within that you would put stress and anxiety and safety. And being alive, of course, is the bottom line on all that. But there are periods where your needs are not necessarily threatened by life, but they're threatened by stress and anxiety and feelings of safety. So that's a basic human need. You would agree with that one, Robert?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Okay.
I like that pyramid I've agreed with for a long time.
And then the next one came along and he says, yeah, that's right. But happiness is also a basic human need. Now, you can't be happy all the time, but life with no happiness is no life. So that philosopher, and I don't have his name, I'll give you the next one with the next need who talked about these guys. But you would agree that life with no happiness is no life, right?
I agree with that, definitely. Yes.
Okay. Then we come to the one that President Trump is very concerned with. And it was coined by Nietzsche, Nietzsche, I believe is how you spell that. And he is a late 19th century philosopher, and he agreed with the previous philosophers that life itself or stress and anxiety and that is a basic need. And he said happiness is a basic need. He says, but he said, power is a greater need. Humans like power. And he went on to describe that. And, of course, in my two books, I equate power with control. So the need to have control over your life, and you can't have control without some form of power. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yes, I agree. Yes.
And, of course, President Trump has a high need for control. And he uses power. He uses power quite a bit. Now, there are actually 9 forms of power. We can get into that later if you want. And which ones does he use the most? There are, of the 9 forms of power, 5 are freeing and 4 are controlling. We might want to take that on next, but you're in control of this, Robert. You take it, your program, anywhere you want to go.
I think this is a good time, you know, to talk about those 9 forms, you know. Because I think that, I would like to talk about those.
Okay, well, let's finish the 5 basic needs and then we'll go to that.
Okay.
Control. Now, control varies greatly between people, from one person to the next. There are control freaks. They have to be in control. If they are not in complete control, they freak out. And then there are people who don't mind being controlled. They want to have some control, but they like it when other people tell them what to do. So you've got that entire variation there of control needs. But control is a need, and if you think that's not a need, ask yourself, Robert, when you feel like you're in control versus when you feel totally out of control, what's the difference for you?
Oh, well, in control feels very empowering, feels very safe and secure and understandable. And, of course, if there are things that are not within my control, that adds to anxiety, uncertainty, all kinds of unhealthy feelings.
Yeah. So Nietzsche said, being in control or having power meets the other two needs. Your feelings for life, safety, security, and anxiety, when you have control, those needs are being met. And to some extent, your happiness, you're not unhappy when you're in control. You may not be happy, but you are not unhappy. You feel good. So we got 3 of the basic needs. And then I've done the research for the last 100 years on the needs, and the next one, I've not really seen it talked about that much, but it is there. It's in the literature. It's in child development. It's in learning in schools. It's in Maslow's hierarchy. It's called caring. And in Maslow, that comes in belonging. Do you feel like you belong? If you feel like you belong, the other people in your environment care about you. So caring is a basic human need. When that need is met, you've got 4 of your basic needs met. And ask yourself, Robert, if you were to wake up tomorrow and realize that nobody, I mean nobody, cares about you as a person, how would you feel?
Oh, yeah. There are people that do that. I mean, it's a very depressing, hopeless kind of a feeling. And I believe, you know, there were studies that show that, you know, when, infants or are not shown that caring or that nurturing, that, you know, the detrimental effects that it has once they get older.
You're absolutely right. That's this touching and this holding and so forth is a caring means of showing caring. But when you get older, the way that people show you that they care is different. But caring is a definite basic human need. And I've often thought that people like Jackson, the singer, and Presley, they had everything in the world. But, you know, I sometimes thought in my mind that they really didn't believe that people cared about them. They only wanted their money. And that may be some of the reasons why they lived the life that they did and didn't take care of themselves. I don't know. That's strictly speculation. But we come to the 5th need. So we got caring, control, happiness, and safety and life itself. Okay. Those are things that cause people to behave the way they do. Now, purpose is the fifth basic need. Now, President Trump's got a purpose. He wants to make America great again. So he's got purpose. We know that. He's got a lot of people in the United States who care about him because they voted for him. He's got a lot of control, and he's not fearful for his life, I don't think. So if you look at, and I know his kids, he's got a lot of people who care about him too. He's got Hannity, he's got lots of people, Gingrich, people who care about him. So all of his five basic needs are being met. So he should be okay for the next year, okay? So now that we've analyzed him. But let's talk about, we'll go back to school for just a minute.
Okay.
I've done lots of research on kids and why they go to school. And I say, why do you go to school? And they said, well, we have to. I said, you mean you wouldn't go if you didn't? No, I don't like school. What do you like about school? Going home, recess. That's about 50% of the kids in school today. They don't have a purpose for going to school. They further believe that 50% of the teachers don't care about them, and more than 50% of the other students don't care about them. They may have a friend or two, but most of the kids don't show caring behaviors toward the other students. It's everybody for themselves. It's a dog-eat-dog world in most schools today. So if you've got a circle of friends in school, if your kid's a student, be thankful. Get them into extracurricular, band, sports, debate clubs. Get them into things where they're going to have friends at school. So they go to school knowing that they've got people there who care about them. The bullies pick on kids who don't have friends, who nobody cares about. Then you get to control itself. Kids don't have much control in school. They're told what to study. They're told what the rules are. They have to. It's like a prison in many ways. And if you look at the literature on that, people will say the most undemocratic institutions in our society are our schools. There's no democracy there. You have to do what you're told to do. You must behave. And in some ways, that's good, because a school that does not have control over what's going on in that school is a risky place to put your kids in. So you want schools to be a safe place. In my two books on this, I talk about how do you give control to teachers? How do you give control to students without giving it up? I don't think we're going to have time for that today, but I can share after we do the power thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how do you give control to your kids? How do you give control to employees? How do you give control to students without giving it up? And in some ways, the nine forms of power are part of that. So there you have it, Robert. That's why people behave the way they do. And when I talk to people about if you were a psychiatrist or a therapist and you were talking to somebody about what they need to do, you would ask them, where are they on a scale of 1 to 10 on these five basic needs? Where are you? In terms of purpose, what's your purpose in life? Are you a 1, a 5, a 10? What is your purpose in life? And if they don't have a purpose, they're at risk. Then you would say, how do you feel about the people in your life who care about you? Do they really care about you? On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate people who care about you? And then I would go to control. How much do you feel like you're in control of your life? On a scale of 1 to 10, do you feel like you have good control? You'd rate yourself an 8, 9, or a 10. You have a little control, you'd rate yourself a 2 or 3. Where would you rate yourself? Once you get this profile of, and how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10? How would you rate yourself? In terms of your life, in terms of the stress and anxiety, how would you rate yourself? Once you get this profile of someone who's talking to you, and Robert, you can do this with your kids. if you have to work with any of your kids or anybody that you have to work with, an employee, ask them to rate themselves on those five needs, and you will know where in terms of their professional development or in terms of what you're going to try to do to help them, you will know where you got a post hole.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. That would definitely identify what area needs attention and how you can do that. But it also to recognize the areas where someone's strength. So, I mean, it really would help, you know.
Yeah, it would.
Both ends, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the nine forms of power. Now, you said some are freeing and some are controlling, correct? Is that what you said?
Right. Now,
okay.
if you go on the web and look up power typology, there is one. It was developed by French and Raven back in the 50s, I believe, 60s, early 60s on leadership. Their original typology had five forms of power. They had, they had position, reward, and control. Anybody who's a leader has position power, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you get position power, you get the ability to reward or punish, right?
Right.
Okay. Those are controlling forms of power. Okay. So those are the three original forms of power that French and Raven identified. Then they identified two other ones that are quite intriguing. One is expertise, and the other is called referent. Oh, I call it personality. In expertise power, a person demonstrates how to swing a golf club, how to do a math problem on the board, how to put something together, how to fix an engine or whatever. And the person looking on watches and says, I see how you did that. I think I can do that. That's a freeing form of power. People watch someone demonstrate how to do something, and they say, yeah, I can do that. And they choose to do it. That's free, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They are free. So give control to someone without giving it up. That's one way to do it. Show them how to do something. And if you are good at demonstrating and they say, yeah, I can do that, that's a form of power. Now, here's the one that when I talk to teachers, they say they use the most. I go through the nine forms of power, and we're now only at number five, and I call it personality power, not referent power. If people like you, all you got to do is ask them to do something, and they'll say, sure. You agree with that?
Yeah, some people have that ability to motivate, for certainly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so teachers, the first thing they want to do is try to get the kids to like them. So all they have to do then is ask them to, would you close the door? Would you give me that? Would you do this? Would you do that? And the kids willingly say, sure, and they do it. They are free to respond, and they do. So that's a freeing form of power. Now let's get at the other three freeing forms of power. We got expertise and personality. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Information, what we're doing right now, is power. People are going to listen to this show, and they're going to say, wow, I never thought about those forms of power before, but yeah. That's right. I'm going to have to think about when I try to get people to do what I want them to do. Or they may say, yeah, I never thought about those five basic needs before. I'm going to ask so-and-so how their needs are being met. Maybe I'll talk to my wife about that. So information is power, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we got information. And then the next step down the line, when you use these forms of power, they are kind of incremental. In other words, there's a place to start. You want to get somebody to do something? The first thing you do is you give them the information. If that doesn't convince them that it's good, then you go to expertise. And you show them how to do it. If that doesn't work, you go to personality. And you might say, hey, well, over the years, haven't I been very good to you, haven't you know, I kind of work on them a little bit that way, their sympathies, their guilt, and you work on personality. And if that doesn't work, you go to ego power. Ego power is nowhere mentioned in the literature. It's there, but I don't think anybody's ever written about it. I got to get on the web when I finish this and look up ego power and see who else has written about it. I think I'm the only one who's written about it. There's a negative ego power, too. Positive ego power would be, hey, Robert, you did such a great job on this last year. How about giving me a hand this year? And Robert says, well, sure, I'll help you out. Freeing form, right?
Right.
You stroke the ego, and they feel good about it, and they decide to help you. Now, the negative ego stroke is a ticklish one. You got to do it with the right person. But if you do it with the right person, it is the most powerful form of power. The example I use in my book is Muhammad Ali. When he was in the fourth grade, his teacher said, Cassius Clay, I believe it is, Cassius, you ain't never going to amount to anything. You're just a, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When he won the Golden Glove in Cuba, guess where he went? The very first thing he did when he got back to the States, he went to that teacher. And he says, you know what you told me when I was in the fourth grade? You said I wouldn't amount to anything. Well, look at what I did. So the negative ego stroke, and coaches use it the most, they can say, you know, we got to play that team across town. They are tough. I'm not so sure we can beat them. What do you think? What do you mean, coach? We're going to beat their butts. And they rise to the negative ego stroke. It's a ticklish one, and I cover that in chapter 4 in book number 1. The whole chapter is on the 9 forms of power, the use and misuse of the 9 forms of power. And we get to the fifth freeing form, which is the most important form. A lot of parents don't use it. It's called moral power. When I was a school superintendent, my board members would fight amongst each other, trying to get, you know, their control over, get their needs met. And on the back, I finally put on the back of the boardroom, what is the right thing to do? And when they get to arguing, I would say, hey, guys, wait a minute. Look at that sign back there. What's the right thing to do here? Let's forget our own personalities and individual needs. What's the right thing to do here? So moral power, when people know what the right thing to do is, normally all you got to do is remind them of it. So when I was a teacher in a classroom, I gave 3 3-by-5 cards to every kid in the classroom. And I said, guys, I want you to write down what you think the rules ought to be in this classroom. And they looked at me like I was, you want us to tell you what the rules are? I'd say, yeah, I'd like to know what you think the rules ought to be. So they would write their rules on each, one rule on each card, and I would get, back in those days, I had 5 classes. I'd get about 100 respond, 300 cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I would quickly sort, I could quickly sort them in the common piles. It didn't take me much more than an hour to sort all those cards into common piles, because they would, many of them would say the same things. Don't play favorites. Return homework on time and on. Make kids stay in their seats. Don't let them talk when they're not supposed to. They almost always have a lot of the same rules, but actually the same ones I had. And the only rule they didn't put in there, very seldom that they would put it in there, was return your homework on time. They didn't want to do that. They didn't want that rule. So I just put it in.
Okay.
And,
right.
And they didn't know it. They didn't know that I put it in. But I would put I put up 10 rules up on the bulletin board, and I say, here are the rules you want me to enforce in this classroom. You see, this was my favorite technique for giving them control without giving it up. I gave them control over the rules. I didn't give it up. But when the rules went up, they would sit there, and I could just see the lights. I wrote that rule. Oh, there's my rule. There's my rule.
Uh-huh.
and they'd be just looking up there at their rules.
Right.
So now when the kids misbehaved, whose rules were they violating?
I see, yes. They got a responsibility.
Their own.
Right.
Yeah. So when I enforced the rule...
Did any ever catch on that the timeliness of homework was not one of theirs?
No. No, they didn't.
Okay.
They might have... I heard some... Who wrote that stupid rule? I did hear that once in a while.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is now, who am I working for?
Mm-hmm.
I'm working for them.
Right, right.
So I have turned the tables on what happens in most classrooms. You ask any kid, who are you working for? And they say the teacher. But when you turn the tables and you get them into the mind of we're in this together, I'm working for you, I'm enforcing your rules, we, as opposed to I and you, it's a different ballgame entirely. Now, parents out there who are listening into this, you can do the same thing. A lot of parents have got two or three kids. You can go to your kids and give them 5 3-by-5 cards and say, what rules do you want to have in this house? So you're going to get back 15 cards from your two or three kids, and you'll have the rules that they think should be enforced in this house. Now, moral power can be put into place because a lot of kids don't really know what the parents expect because the rules aren't never been written. They aren't clear.
Right.
They have to find out about them because when they violate a rule and the parents chew them out, they find out. Well, sometimes they got to get chewed out 5 or 6 times before they really realize that that's the rule that mom and dad want enforced in this house. But if you were to do the 3-by-5 cards, you could find, and then you could put your own rules in. You say, guys, this is what the rules you think ought to be in this house. And you share it with them. And then
right.
You say, here's a couple of rules you didn't mention that I think we have to have.
Right.
So you've got a list of rules. Now, moral power is in place. Now, the same thing can occur in every organization that's listening in on this conversation, whether it's a business, whether it's the post office, whether it's a church, deacons, whatever it is, moral power is only in place once people know what is expected of them in terms of the right thing to do. If that is not known, moral power is not in place. Now, many schools will have handbooks with rules, but there are so daggone many rules that the kids forget them. But anyway...
Right. Yes.
So we get the 5 freeing forms: information, expertise, personality, ego, and moral power. When those rules are used, people who hear them are free to respond. When they do not respond, if you're a leader, you have to take control back and use position, reward, and coercion power. Because if you're a leader, whether you're a parent or all people in their own way are leaders, they're leading somebody. If you're a leader, if you don't take control back and enforce the rules, you lose your position power. Once people know you don't enforce the rules, you're done.
Yep. That's
as a leader.
Exactly.
You can walk into Walmart every day and see parents who have given up control to their kids.
Absolutely.
And it's pathetic. It is pathetic.
I agree.
Now, there is a 9th form of power that we've not mentioned, and it is a controlling form of power. It's called connection power. Connection power. The example I like to use the best is parents. Let's say mom and dad have position power. You agree?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Over their kids. Outside of their family, they may not have position power, but over their kids, they've got position power if they haven't given it up.
Right.
Okay, let's suppose one of the kids misbehaves. Mom says, I don't like what you just did. I'm going to tell your dad about this when he gets home, and we'll see what he does about that. And the kid says, "No, Mom, don't tell Dad." So, Mom, "I'm going to tell your dad." So Dad comes home, and Mom says, you know what your kid did today? And Mom explains what the kid did that she thought was bad. And Dad says, "Oh, my God, I did that when I was a kid. What's so bad about that? What's so bad about that? I don't think we ought to do anything about that." "What? Well, I'm serious. I did that when I was a kid." And Dad does not support Mom. What happens to Mom's position power?
Right. It gets kind of cut down.
Yeah, it does. So connection power, any person who gets a leadership position has connection power. Trump has connection power with the people through his Twitters and so forth. He does not have connection power with the media.
No.
He still seems to have connection power with Congress.
Some.
lost it. So he still has position, reward, and coercion power. Now, when you get to President Obama, he had lost connection power with Congress, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he used executive power. He says, "Screw you guys. I've got the pen right here. I got executive power. I'm going to write my own." So he pretty much lost position power with Congress, but he still had executive power with the media and to some extent with a lot of the public. So he was still okay. So those are the 9 forms of power. I don't know what you thought about that, but...
Well, that's good. No, I like recognizing the freeing forms and the controlling forms. It's just, quite often when some people speak about power, we often run right to the negative, the controlling aspect, not recognizing the positive influence of power. So
that's wrong with most of our public schools today. The controlling forms of power are used, and because students and faculty, teachers, and other employees have a need to control, when you control them, the more you control a person, the more they tend to resist.
Yeah.
So it's when you use the freeing forms, you increase motivation. You increase acceptance of responsibility. You empower people, and they will put forth more energy to get things done. The more you control them, the more you depower them, the more they resist, the less likely they are to put forth the extra energy. So that's one of the main things wrong with our schools today. And a lot of organizations are over-controlling as well.
Yeah, some of the better ones offer free. Well, we're a little past halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick break.
Okay.
And then when we come back, I want to talk about a couple other factors that play into relationships, and those being openness and trust, two very important areas. Okay? Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Everyone, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Dr. Cleet Belock, and we're talking about the factors of human relationships. Again, you can find out more by visiting his website at www.westga.edu, and I do have a direct link to his web page there in the show page description. Okay, so with that, Dr. Cleet, we're back.
Hey, good to be back.
Hey, okay, great. So we've been talking about power as a factor with relationships, power and control. But now, what about the openness and trust? Those are some real important aspects that I think kind of contribute to some of the dysfunction with relationships.
Absolutely, it's probably the worst. It's one of the six causes for low test scores in schools and a major cause for low performance in any organization. I did my doctoral dissertation on openness, trust, and risk-taking. What is the relationship? Will you take a risk with someone you don't trust? Will you be open with someone you don't trust? In any relationship, whether it's a first date or a marriage or in any organization, how open are people with each other? How much do they trust each other? Are they willing to take risks? Openness has two factors. It has a telling and a listening factor. A lot of people are very open on the telling factor. People accuse Trump of being open on telling and not so much on listening, but I honestly think he is pretty good at both. But a lot of people in schools, teachers and administrators tend to be open on telling. Here's a technique I used to kind of put that thing to rest, to try to improve openness and trust. Actually, I've got two techniques I'm going to share with you. I went to the faculty at my first meeting with them as superintendent and as principal. I gave them 3 3x5 cards, and I said, I want to know what you expect of me as your principal, as your superintendent. And they look at you like you're crazy. You want us to tell you what we expect? Yeah, I want to know what you expect. And they would write there on each card one expectation. I'd get all the cards back, and I would sort them into common piles, and I would paraphrase what was in each pile. And the next meeting, I would say, this is what you said you expect of me, and I would share it with them. And I would say, I'm going to do my best to meet your expectations. Here's one expectation that a few of you said that I don't think I can meet, and I would explain why. But I showed them that I was open on the listening dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Not just on the telling, but I was listening to them. I cared about them. I trusted them. I was willing to take the risk to listen to what they had to say before we got into a relationship. I was working on relationships between them and me. And it worked beautifully. So we were off to usually a really good start with that first day with using that technique. I call it the expectations diagnosis. Now, let me tell you why that's so important. Teachers in today's schools and administrators, the faculty comes from all walks of life. You've got blacks, whites, Latinos, Orientals. They all have different expectations because they come from different cultures. How do you know what they expect? Now, if Trump were to do that with the media, if he were to invite them into a social and give all the media people a 3x5 card and say, I want better relationships with the media. I want you to write down one thing that you expect of me as your president. And he were to get all that back, he might turn the relationship with them where they might even start trusting him. I don't know.
Okay. The expectation. That's a tough one. That's a tough ask. But yeah, you're right.
That would be a big one, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that might be. But
I did that as a teacher.
The openness is really important. The openness is an important part of that.
It is. But you are trusting them when you do that. You are opening yourself up.
Right.
So it's a two-way street. I did that as a teacher. Teachers don't know what those kids expect. They look out there and they see all colors, all walks of life, rich, poor. They don't know what those kids expect of them.
Right.
And that gets at the underlying culture that's in that classroom, because culture is what people value and believe should happen. They don't know. If they were to find that out, they would be much more effective. So that's a technique that I use. Here's the another one I use to get at to improve on levels of openness and trust. Trust is five factors. Let me share that with you, but let me share this technique with you because I think your listeners will really enjoy it. I call it the PMI, the positive, minus, and interesting. P, positive, M, minus, I, interesting. Anytime you have a group that meets, you can start off your meeting with a PMI. Anytime you have a faculty meeting, a church meeting, any kind of a meeting, you start with a PMI, and you say to them, "Hey guys, tell you what, I'd like to find out a little bit more about what your life was like this past week or this past month or this past year or this past summer." You say, think about what was positive during that period of time, what was a minus during that period of time, and what was an interesting during that period of time. And I'm going to go first. I'm going to share with you what was positive and minus and interesting about my life during that period of time, and then you share with them what was yours. You say, okay. Now, when you got in your mind a positive, a minus, and an interesting that you're willing to share with the group, give me a thumbs up. So you give them usually 5 minutes,
right,
before they come up with their PMI. Who wants to go first? Give me your positive, minus, and interesting. So what you're doing is you're getting people to open up. You're getting people to listen. You're getting people to understand what's going on in the lives of everybody in your group. And you are legitimizing bragging. Give me a positive. You're legitimizing stating negatives, a minus. And then, of course, the interesting one is what's really interesting, because you never know what that's going to be. So each person in your group then shares, and everybody says, "Well, I didn't know that about you." You're trying to create openness and trust within a group. Now, if you've got a group of 30 or more, I described this in the book, book two, you separate them into groups of five, and you have them share their PMI within their group. Because if you do 30 people, it's going to take too much time. You know, you'd spend almost well over a half an hour to an hour getting 30 people to share their PMI. But when you do it by groups, then you say, okay, in group number one, who wants to share their most significant positive and their most significant minus and their most significant? So each group gives a PMI. So within a matter of 5 minutes, you've got five groups. You can get out the PMIs in five groups. What do you think about that?
Well, that's good. You're right. I mean, it really does. The result of doing that exercise really, I would think it would promote, like greater teamwork and understanding, you know, that idea of caring. You would also learn what's important to people, what are people's values, that from that moral power to, kind of where they stand. So you would learn a lot about the individual. So I would think that would, once you do that, you not only as an administrator or principal to teacher, you have a greater understanding, but also peer-wise between the teachers, there would be a much greater cohesiveness.
Yeah. It's amazing what it does. It creates a feel-good. I mean, when they finish sharing, they feel good. It's a warm, fuzzy type thing. It's a great way to start any meeting, any conference, any session. I have used it over and over and over. I have never had a bad incident with that particular technique. So trust has five factors, and most people don't think about them that much. They just say, well, do you trust so-and-so? And they'll say, yeah or no. Well, what don't you trust him on? I just don't trust him. Well, why not? There's five factors. There's truthfulness. He doesn't tell the truth. Senator Durbin. He doesn't tell the truth. That's what they say. I look at what's going on in our government and not what's being reported and all these human relations things. I just tick them off. Truthfulness is a factor in trust. When it comes to President Clinton, we'll take him as an example of trust. Truthfulness, would you trust him? No. Ability, would you trust him on ability? Yeah, he was a great president. The guy was really able, very sharp when it came to being the president. He was shrewd.
Uh-huh.
So on ability, a lot of people trusted him. I trusted him on ability, but not on truthfulness. Overall character dimension, that's authenticity. Who are you? Do you care about the people? Or do you care about yourself? No. I would not trust him on that variable. Do you come across as a caring individual? Do you come across as someone who's there to serve the needs of others? Or do you come across as someone who's there to serve the needs of self? Self-serving leaders versus servant leaders are night and day. So that is a trust dimension. That's the third one. The fourth one is confidentiality. If you break a confidence, you tell someone something in confidence and they break it and you find out about it, you will never trust them on that again. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Then you come to a very intriguing trust factor. It's called predictability. How predictable as a leader, as a father or a mother, or as a deacon, or as a minister, or as a priest, or whatever your role in life is, how predictable are you? If people come to you with a problem, and one time you say, oh my gosh, you're right. That is something we really need to deal with. I tell you what, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to get back to you on this, and you let me know how things are going, okay? So that's one. And then you come to that same person with a problem the next time, and they say, what do you mean? I don't see that. Is that your problem? Are you the problem on this? Or is that really a problem? I don't see that as a problem. So the position the person took on one was one very helpful, very sympathetic, goes to bat for you, and on the other, they turn it around, and they wonder if you're the problem. Unpredictable. So trust in that dimension, as a leader, if you're not predictable, they aren't going to come to you with problems.
Yeah.
So that trust is a very complicated issue, but those are the five factors. There is a survey on my website, and it's free to any organization out there, measuring levels of openness and trust within a group. You can measure openness and trust between the leader and a group. And that's on my website, and it's free. Incidentally, when you mention my website, there is a /between that tilt and my name.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah,
but again,
okay.
It's in there. The direct link is in there. So we're kind of down toward the end of the show, which is, I'm sure we just touched the tip of the iceberg. But and I'm glad that you mentioned that survey on your website, because you also have other surveys on there.
Yeah,
as well.
They're all free.
They're all free? Okay.
They're all free.
Okay.
They can send me an email and they can send me an email and request the survey, and I'll attach it.
Great. Well, that's perfect, because there's some really good, topics there, for especially for those in the field of education, you know, that would be really worthwhile. So, and then also on your webpage, you have links where people can buy your books as well, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, Dr. Klee, again, you know, we covered needs, power, openness, trust. So much that we covered, and again, it's I'm sure, like I say, the tip of the iceberg. But when it comes to human relationships, there's just a lot of factors that we have to consider, and I like the where you added, you know, the caring and belonging part as far as, you know, one of the needs that, you know, we often don't talk about, but it's a very real need.
Yeah, well, you've got an interesting website, too. You're doing some interesting work. I've got a question I'd like to ask you when we're offline.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely. You can ask me. Got my email. Contact me, or I'll send you my cell phone number, and we can talk that way, too.
That's right. I've got your email here. I'll ask you my question.
Okay. That sounds great. Well, Dr. Klee, I really want to thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed our talk.
Yeah, I appreciate interacting with you.
Right. Bye. It's my pleasure. All right. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Cleet Belak, and we have been talking about the factors of human relationships. Again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.